right, and welcome to Fast Break Breakfast NBA Podcast. My name is Keith, here alone for an interview episode discussing the Philadelphia 76ers, the process, and my boy Tony Roten. Chuck and John will be back tomorrow, I think, for a full episode. We had a fun watch party watching the Grizzlies play the Cavs last night. So Chuck and John will be back with a full episode for Friday morning. But today's episode, all about the Sixers with Max Rappaport.
So we interrupt this great podcast that you're listening to. My name is Kevin Rafuse.
I'm Tim Tompkins.
And I'm Justin Cousart.
And we host the Drive and Dish NBA Podcast.
We cover every team in the league and a bunch of really fun segments like Random NBA Player, Drive and Dougal, and Hot Takes from Reddit.
So when you're done listening to this podcast, give us a search on iTunes or whatever podcast streaming app you're listening on.
We're also at driveanddishpodcast.com. We are the Drive and Dish NBA Podcast.
My guest today is a writer and a podcaster. You can find him at Complex Sports and Liberty Ballers covering the Sixers. He also co-hosts the Step Over Pod and makes novelty process-based t-shirts. Mr. Max Rappaport, how are you doing?
That, you know, it's funny. That describes like 10 different people on Twitter, I feel like.
Right.
The novelty t-shirts, the podcast.
Well, I live in Nashville, and I'm a freelance, sort of was a freelance musician. I still do some music work. I'm mainly a stay-at-home dad / podcaster. And the joke in Nashville is if you don't have a band and a podcast, like, you're way behind. It's like when you fill out a resume, it's kind of like, all right, now what's your podcast and what's your band? Okay. All right. No, yeah, no, the position's filled, but thanks for asking. So let's get this right. You are a disciple, evangelist, and an apologist for the process. You are a true believer.
Yes. So I actually worked for the Sixers back at the beginning of the process. That was I worked for their website and did social media for them. So I was like truly in the thick of the process, like behind enemy lines with the process. I've been a process supporter since day one. I'm sure that's a lot of what we'll talk about is the process and where it stands now.
Yeah.
For lack of a better term, I'm a process person.
Okay, so as a process person, before I attack your entire belief system, it is our tradition and a courtesy to ask you if you had breakfast and what you might have eaten for breakfast.
You know, I normally don't eat breakfast, but I decided to today, and I made like a protein shake, and I was gonna do like banana and peanut butter. And I started making it, like put everything in the Nutribullet, and then realized I didn't have peanut butter. So it ended up just being like milk and banana mixed together with a little bit of protein powder. It was pretty actually.
Are you actively working out, or was that just like you're like, you know what, I need a little protein boost today?
So yeah, I've been trying to work out. I'm in a master's program for psychology. That's why I left my job at the Sixers and started doing this weird amalgam of Twitter and online things instead.
Uh-huh.
But I'm on break right now, so this is like the one time of the year, or the three times of the year when I'm on break where I like try to actually do exercise. So I've been doing that the last week, which is nice.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Well, it sounds like I guess like a banana milkshake wouldn't be that terrible. Like if it was me,
you know, it sounds way better than it is.
I think your ingredients was you missed maybe some sugar. I don't know if you had some like flavored coffee creamer. That's what I would have poured in there. Just tried to give it that extra. I'm a sugar addict, so that's not good for me. All right. Well, so turning to the Sixers, and I guess I do have a lot of questions big picture wise. So when you were working for the Sixers and everyone was like, wow, that Andrew Bynum trade, that was bad because it turns out he can't play basketball and or doesn't want to do it anymore. And they said, we're going to embrace being terrible. So at that moment in time, were you thinking this is a great idea because we haven't had much playoff success, and it does seem like maybe the best way to go is to bottom out for a while?
Yeah, you know, I think that's the big thing that gets lost when you talk to people who support the process versus people who don't outside the city, especially, is the context of the Sixers the last 15 years, really. I mean, really, since 2003-ish, and especially since Iverson was traded in 2006, the team's just been like in that middle ground that nobody wants to be in, and was for a long time. And even during a lot of the Iverson era, but, you know, other than right around 2000, you know, the team's kind of just been floating between like 35, 43 wins, maybe make the playoffs. If they do, get knocked out probably in five games in the first round if they're lucky. So I think people were just ready for something different. And actually, people were super on board with the Bynum trade. That was like, at the time, you know, the Sixers had finished as the eight seed the year before, snuck past the Bulls after Derrick Rose got hurt and Joakim Noah banged up his ankle in that first round series. And then almost they were one game away from making it to the Eastern Conference Finals against Boston. So, you know, I think people weren't fooled. Like, you know, you look at that team and Jrue Holiday was their best player. You had like Thaddeus Young, Evan Turner, Andre Iguodala. And maybe Iguodala was their best player at that time. But, you know, when they made that deal for Bynum, it was seen as, okay, they're consolidating some of these assets and like making this move they got to move or got to do to like take the next step. And then obviously it blew up in their faces. But I think at that point, you know, Sixers fans were ready for something different because they're, you know, going into Hinkie's first year, his first draft when he traded Jrue Holiday, it was Jrue Holiday and then a bunch of, you know, fine players, you know, Spencer Hawes back when he was better than he is now, Thaddeus Young, Evan Turner. You know, I think people just didn't see where that was going. And if you were going to pick between 10 and 15 every year with that core, what do you, like, where are you going from there?
Yeah. So at that time, was there a time, did you have a time frame in mind as a fan that like, this is going to be bad for 3 years or 2 years? Like, what do you think?
Yeah.
Remember what your time frame was?
You know, I probably thought three, which would put us, you know, this is year four.
Yeah.
And they're still really bad. You know, I think there's, sure, we'll get into like more of the specifics of it. I think there are a lot of reasons it's taken as long as it has. But I think that's one reason that people were super on board in the beginning. And I would say that I was a little, you know, I think 3 years was like somewhat more reasonable. There were people who were like, all right, we'll tank for Wiggins for 1 year. We'll get Wiggins. Then we'll be, that's our superstar. And then we'll move ahead with that. And like people were really looking at it like, all right, this is a 1 year tank. And then we're like out of the weeds, not thinking about the fact that like, all right, if you don't get Wiggins and if you're put in a situation like the Sixers were, where you're drafting a player, whether it's Embiid or it's just a more raw prospect, like who's not going to contribute right away, this might take a little bit longer. And then obviously Embiid missing 2 years, the fact that where they were drafting, it made sense. And we could talk about the Okafor pick, but even if they had taken Porzingis, it made sense to take a big every year. There were just a lot of reasons that it just didn't pan out. I think people imagine like, okay, year one, we'll get Wiggins. Year two, we'll get some point guard. Year three, we'll, you know, then we'll have Noel. And like, it doesn't really work like that when you're rebuilding. It rarely does.
Right. And I think that's one of the main criticisms of the process is there's so much left to chance and there's so many ways to build a team that guaranteeing that you're going to be bad seems like kind of a rough way to go about it. Even if it did, you know, I guess Sixers fans, and I'm going to only try to say Stockholm Syndrome one time, you know, you guys have convinced or, you know, it's like as a fan, you try to look at the most optimistic output or you try to convince yourself of like when there's a trade made, you're like, yeah, this is how it can work out for my team. And I understand now as the Sixers, even though it is year four, that you say, look at all these assets we have, look at all this potential we still have. It somehow erases the fandom aspect of just watching your team play every night and like enjoying the process of the games of just winning basketball games. And I think a lot of that, I guess it could just be based on geographic and what like my particular fandom is. Like I live in Nashville. We've always been a small market as far as sports. Like we had the Tennessee Titans. Like they made the Super Bowl once. It was awesome. But like, and then like I've been a fan of the Grizzlies since they started 16 years ago. And it's always like, I don't anticipate us being a championship contender. So like this great 6 year run of the Grizzlies of just making the playoffs and being like, you know, we were top five in ESPN's power rankings for 2 months in a row. You know, like that part's fun. So I guess, how do you reconcile the process, the capital P process of what the Sixers are doing of accepting we're not going to have any of that other fan type stuff for the hope of maybe something happening deep in the future?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the hard part because, you know, I was one of those people back even those years I was talking about were you know, Iguodala and Drew Holiday were the best players in the team. Like, I was the guy who, when they drafted Evan Turner in 2010, like, held on to hope way too long that Evan Turner was going to figure it out and be that Paul Pierce that everyone thought he was when he came out of the draft. And, like, you know, I think fan bases naturally do that. You try to envision how your team can take that step, or how your team can, you know, get hot, you know, in April and ride that in the playoffs. And I think as a Grizzlies fan, like, you guys are in that. I mean, I envy the Grizzlies, you know, even though they're not necessarily a championship contender or haven't been in some of these years they've been good. Like, I don't know, if the Sixers came out of this and were a high seeded playoff team for a number of years in a row, like, I don't know if that's a failure. I think what people miss is the Sixers didn't give up to do this. The Sixers didn't give up what the Grizzlies have. They gave up what the Milwaukee Bucks have,
right?
You know, or not even like what the Atlanta Hawks right now have, minus those 2 years where they were really good. So I just think it's, you know, for me, if you want to talk about Stockholm syndrome, I think I had Stockholm syndrome then, when I was like looking at thinking of Doug Collins as one of the top 10 coaches in the league, and like how, you know, bringing in Andrew Bynum is going to be the thing that, you know, he's going to be an MVP candidate. And, you know, every fan base does that. I think what the process did for me as a fan is, it was a totally different viewing experience. Like, you're totally right that this is maybe the first year since it started, and the team's still really bad, but this is the first year where, like, I don't have in the back of my mind that, like, them losing is better than them winning. Because at this point, you know, they've stocked up enough. I think the development of the players on the roster, especially Embiid and Simmons, is more important than maximizing lottery odds. When Nerlens Noel was the best prospect on the team, I didn't feel that way. But so now I'm like starting to get back into the mindset of like thinking about wins and losses. But it was a different kind of fandom, and I had a lot of fun those first three years of it, and especially the first 2 years before, you know, Jill Okafor punched someone in the face and Jerry Colangelo was thrust upon us. Like, those were really fun years because the wins and losses didn't matter. You couldn't be upset at any outcome. Like, if they won a game, that's great because, you know, it's such a young team and it's the guys you're hoping to move forward with winning you games. And when they lost, it's like, all right, that's fine. I don't really care. And it was kind of a fun atmosphere for that reason.
Well, I think you're putting that the fact that it became a fun atmosphere, that the fans grabbed onto this identity. And I understood that, like, that process of it, the fun of, I gotta stop saying process, that concept of you guys enjoying the badness for a while, knowing that there's a goal in mind in the future. And like, I consider myself to be a hipster for my whole, you know, since like college 15 years ago, where like I enjoyed the Spice Girls kind of ironically, and Hanson, and like I love watching bad movies, and there's some part about it like, oh, we're terrible, but there's a hope where it is fun to watch bad basketball. And I'm also, I guess, a League Pass junkie where I watch the bad teams throughout the year. Like, sometimes I miss Clippers Warriors because I want to see the Kings and the Suns play. Like, that somehow seems more interesting. Mm-hmm. But so what will a acceptable outcome of the process be at this point? Like, if you guys hit the point where you are, I think you mentioned just making the second round and you have like a good like 51 team at that point, do you say, okay, like, we're done, that it was kind of worth it?
To me, you know, it's hard because I don't think I've ever really conceptualized like what that looks like. I think for me, the big thing was when they started the process, they probably had anywhere between a 2% and a 5% chance of building a contender around that roster. You know, if they just like went on as constructed. Now I think that's a lot higher, and you know, that may not pan out. Joel Embiid might get hurt again, and then it, you know, all kind of goes away. I think at this point I wouldn't call the process like a success, because that would be unfair, but I think it's done what it was supposed to do, and it's given you a chance and it's given you something to hope for. And especially you see what Embiid's doing, and the hope is that Ben Simmons comes back and is as good as he looked in summer league and early in training camp, and as good as you just thought he was going to be as a prospect. But you know, to me, it was just having that chance. I guess, you know, it's tough because I think if those guys pan out, it, I guess the worst case would be you're like the Kings, like, you know, Embiid's your boogie and you're, you know, you have that guy, or you're like the Pelicans, like you have that guy, but that's not getting you anywhere. But I'd still so much rather be that than the team that doesn't have that guy. Even a, you know, even like the Hornets, you know, a team that's better when you don't have that guy. I just feel like it's not, you know, you can hope that something breaks your way, or that you draft a Kawhi Leonard in the middle of the first round. But other than that, you're really, you don't have any hope for more than what you, where you are right now.
I think the Hornets are a great example. That's a team that, as you said, they don't have a guy. They don't have an elite. This guy is what you would consider you'd build your team around. And they don't really have any path to improve either. It's got to be all internal, all kind of what this squad can do. And they're probably going to max out, you know, as I guess there's a chance they could be the Eastern Conference finalist alongside the Cavs, but most people would not anticipate that. Like, they seem to have a top ceiling. And then I guess you get into philosophical discussions of what as a fan do you need or require of your team. And I feel like for the Hornets, it might be like, hey, this is a fun couple year run, maybe 3 year run of getting to the second round. But I'm curious, if there is a setback, if there is another injury for either Embiid or Simmons, or you guys do make a trade for Nerlens, you know, you trade away Okafor, Newell, and then something about whoever you get in doesn't work out. If there's another setback in like this year, does the team then look at next year and say, well, we need to be bad again? Or now that maybe Colangelo's in charge, it's going to be more of a traditional team building, like we just have to improve no matter what?
You know, it's tough. I guess the doomsday scenario is like Embiid gets hurt and it's, you know, another like season ending surgery, and then his career is just, you know, in question. And then Ben Simmons, when he comes back, just isn't as good as you thought he was going to be, or he's, you know, in and out because of injury. I guess in that case where you're like back at square one, I don't know what you do. I think the right thing would be to keep rebuilding, but I just don't see how the team can do that. You know, financially they've sacrificed to do this. Even though they haven't spent a lot during the years they've been tanking, you make significantly less money being a team that everyone knows is going to be bad when the year starts.
I kind of anticipate that maybe the NBA also, I'm a vague conspiracy theorist, that maybe the NBA has a agreement that the Sixers are done doing the definitely racing towards the bottom. Like when Jerry Colangelo was given control in a bloodless coup that seemed to be orchestrated by the NBA to you know, get rid of Sam Hinkie, and, you know, I guess initially the report was to work alongside, but that wasn't going to work. And in return, I'm assuming, so it seemed to me as an outsider and conspiracy theorist, the NBA put Jerry Colangelo in place, who then appointed his son as the best candidate he could find anywhere to run the team. And then it seemed like maybe the league was like, we're going to kind of table lottery reform. Like, we're not going to talk about lottery reform anymore. And you guys are cool. You'll keep your picks. But just, you're going to start building towards the future and, you know, trade second round picks for Ish Smith and do tiny things that will maybe win you a couple games.
I will say it's coincidental that a month after Brian Colangelo got hired, they finally got the number one pick. So
yeah, and then exactly, and they're like, and you know what? We'll take care of the draft this year. Just, you know, let's stop talking about lottery reform. Let's start winning some ball games.
Yeah, you know, I think you're right that I just don't think they can. You know, I think the fans have endured a lot, and the fans largely, I was shocked at the time, you know, how many fans have been on board with this. And, you know, there were people who didn't agree with the, you know, even if it worked, just didn't like the idea of it, didn't think it was what sports were about, thought Sam Hinkie was a fraud and a, you know, nerd with a calculator. Like, there was that. But I think around when it started, probably half the fan base, and especially the like more rabid fan base, was behind it. I don't know how much longer they could be like this bad. And this is actually like a better year for them, and they're, you know, watchable now. But I don't think they could like tank without Embiid and Simmons and really do that. I think they'd have to figure out some other way.
Yep. I will say, you talk about how a lot of the fans got behind it and there's been some more excitement. I will say one thing I saw that you Philadelphia fans enjoyed that I've never experienced was on lottery night. I saw a video of some gathering of Sixers fans at like a gigantic I don't know what it mm-hmm. was. There was like thousands of people, and people lost their minds like when the pick went off. And I was like, that's really cool. Like, look at all those people. I guess that's the one release of emotion based on 3 years of we've been waiting for the top pick.
Yeah, I'd be remiss if I didn't give credit to Spike Eskin and Mike Levin of the Rights to Ricky Sanchez podcast who put that together. They've done it the last 3 years, and this last one was unbelievable. There were like 1,500 people or 2,000 people at this huge bar down by the stadiums.
Well, I was blown away. I was just saying, I've never even seen a bar like that where like 1,500 yeah. people could sit or all stand packed together.
It's kind of like if you've been down by Staples Center, it's like LA Live. It's similar kind of thing down by like the stadium complex in Philly. They have this huge like multi-bar, you know, auditorium where you can watch games and stuff. It's pretty cool. But yeah, that was crazy. I think, you know, you said it was like a cathartic release. It's the one time every year where Sixers fans could like actually care about a result instead of a process.
Yeah.
So that was, you know, it's kind of that like a year brewing of like not being able to actually root, like care that much about the outcome of games as a fan to be able to actually like watch something and really care about the result.
Right. All right. So talking more about the players and less about the philosophy, I'm curious, over the last 3 years, as an outsider or just a league pass junkie watching these games, I'm curious, has this process of playing, I said it again, has where the Sixers end up playing guys you wouldn't normally play a lot of minutes, has that proven to you that maybe a lot of guys, if just given NBA minutes, can make it? As in, most second round picks fail across the NBA, but the Sixers, almost every one of their second round picks for like the last 4 years has become an NBA rotation player to some point. And I'm curious if it's just the fact that, hey, if you give Jeremy Grant and Lavoie Allen and whoever else, like Robert Covington, if you just give them 30 minutes a night for 82 games, like these guys can develop into players.
You know, it's funny you ask that. That's something I think has been kind of an underrated or something that not a lot of people have talked about. You know, I like to think, or I've always thought that circumstance is so important, whether it's where a player gets drafted or where they get an opportunity or what camp they, you know, what team's camp they sign on to or summer league roster. I think it's crazy. I mean, you look like Isaiah Cannon still in the league and getting minutes. Jakarr Sampson's floating around. You mentioned Jeremy Grant got, you know, the Thunder traded a first round pick to get him right. and like really targeted him. It's weird. You know, I think it's a little weird. And even like Hollis Thompson, he's still with the team, but he's in his fourth year and the minutes leader of the process. Like it's kind of weird when you think about like what could have happened if any of those players had been drafted by the Thunder or by the Chicago Bulls or, you know, the Heat back when LeBron was there or whatever it is. Like, players' success is so dependent on the circumstance. I think the process has really illustrated that.
Yeah, I was thinking, because you can't, I honestly can't give the Sixers credit for finding like 9 diamonds in the rough. It's trying to, and so I guess the problem, or I guess the issue becomes trying to translate what these guys have done on a bad team to how that will translate if they leave, you know, if they go to another team that's better or when the Sixers actually get good. Like I think Jeff Van Gundy once said, like, if you take a D-League team and put them in the NBA, somebody's going to average 20 points a game. So it is curious where a guy like Hollis Thompson, where you watch him on League Pass and he's hitting 40% of his threes, like, hey, that guy's pretty good. Or a guy like Robert Covington, who I think most everyone, like all of NBA Twitter, like everyone loves Robert Covington. He seems fun. He gets a lot of steals. He gets on really hot streaks and we forget his, you know, 8-game slumps. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, so my curiosity is, how do you translate the success you see statistically in the last 3 years, and how much do you think that's going to carry over? Like, I'm so curious about Robert Covington. Like, I still don't know if he's good, even though I really like him.
Yeah, I think that's totally valid. I think, you know, I think it's there are a lot of different dynamics at play. Like, you know, you look at a guy like Tony Roden, who puts up a really good raw stats, points, rebounds, assists when he was with the Sixers. I think his first start, he had a triple-double. And you could kind of tell watching him that, like, okay, he's really benefiting from being able to do whatever he wants. I think he had, like, the 10th highest usage rate in the NBA one season when he was starting for the Sixers his second year. You could just tell that wasn't real, you know, just watching it, just with the eye test and, like, thinking about contextually, like, why are his raw stats so good? But then you look at a guy like, I'd say Hollis Thompson, and it's like, you know, yeah, he's getting looks, I guess. He's getting opportunities to play. But if you're a three-point shooter, like, is it better to have talent around you or not have talent around you? So, I think some guys have actually, you know, been hurt by the lack of talent, certainly. Like, Jahlil Okafor is a guy who got to do a lot more, offensively because the team needed him to do it. But he was also playing with, 70 or 72 or whatever percent of his baskets were unassisted. So he's just going one-on-one every play. I try to look at stuff like that to tease it out, and obviously just watching games. I think a guy like Hollis Thompson or even Robert Covington might be better suited, playing 15 or 20 minutes off the bench for a good team where they're actually going to get open looks. Like, Hollis Thompson gets pretty open looks. Robert Covington really doesn't. He's contested a lot, and it's this year's a little bit better because they have Sergio Rodriguez, and Embiid, draws some attention. But back when, like, Nerlens Noel and TJ McConnell and Tony Roden were playing a lot with Robert Covington, like, that wasn't helping him at all. So I don't know. I think it kind of swings both ways.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I gotta say, I'd be remiss not to mention Tony Roden is, I have a soft spot for Tony Roden. I love that guy, even though I know he's probably highly damaging to any team he plays on when he's actually on the court.
Him and Pierre Jackson are playing for the Texas Legends right now.
Oh.
I was trying to see if they're coming on the East Coast, but it doesn't look like they are.
That's pretty spectacular. So this team this year is showing a lot of promise. Obviously, the Joel Embiid thing has been amazing. How do you temper your expectations, and when can we NBA fans get used to him maybe playing every game and being someone you can maybe totally build around?
So I'll answer the first question. It's really hard. It's really hard to stay grounded about it because it's just the type of player he is. He's 7'2". He doesn't really have any. Other than turning the ball over and committing dumb fouls, like, he doesn't really have any weaknesses. Like, he's leading the NBA in 3-point shooting, or was recently. I think his number of attempts is down because he's missed games and plays limited minutes. But he's shooting like 50% from three. His true shooting 60%. Per 36, he's averaging like 30, 12, four blocks and 2.5 assists. You look at, like, historically and try to compare him to guys, who are his size, have his touch. The Sixers are number one in defense with him on the floor and 25th with him off it. Like, I don't know how you can look at any of that and not go, like, this guy is going to be unbelievable if he stays healthy. And, you look at comps and you try to make comparisons to past players, and it's like, guys who do that, who are that impactful at the center position on both ends of the floor, like, there's a handful of them every 10, every generation, really. And I don't know how you can look at them and, like, I think Marc Gasol's like to me, when I look at Marc Gasol, and Marc Gasol's a great player and super impactful, it's like, that almost seems like, if he stays healthy, his absolute low end, being that impactful on defense and, a good shooter and really good rebounder and passer, like, I mean, his ceiling is ridiculous. I don't even know what to say. It's like David Robinson, or it's.
I mean, I like that you said Shaq. His floor is first team All NBA. That's what. That's the Marc Gasol comparison.
I don't know what to say. I don't know what else to say.
Yeah, no. I mean, I don't watch college basketball, and so I'd never seen him play. Like, and I mean, up until this season, and it was like, so it's been pretty exciting. We're like, wow, this guy really is. They weren't joking. This guy looks good when he plays.
Yeah, and it's like the team is basically night and day when he comes off the floor, and part of that's because Jahlil Okafor comes on the floor when Joel Embiid comes off the floor. But I mean, the Sixers right now, I forget the exact number, on the season, they have a positive net rating with Joel Embiid on the floor. Like, they outscore their opponents with Joel Embiid on the floor. Like, they're a winning team. If Embiid played every minute, they would have a winning record.
Yeah.
And this is a team that's 6-18.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard to imagine, and especially, as I've said, like, I've only seen Ben Simmons play summer league. Like, part of me, like, I've texted friends and be like, man, like those poor Sixers, I can't even imagine if Ben Simmons was playing, because he seems cool too. Like, it'd be so great. It does seem sad. Like, but not to dwell on that sadness, but are we going to see Ben Simmons this year? Is he going to come back like anytime soon or All-Star break?
Well, the Sixers have been, you know, despite all that stuff about, you know, I think Sam Hinkie got a really bad rap for, and rightfully so, for being secretive and not really being available to the media, at least on the record, all that much. The Sixers have kind of continued to be pretty secretive about injuries, about, like, Brian Colangelo is not really talking that much to the media. And they really haven't said anything definitive about Ben Simmons. You know, they haven't really given a timeline. Yesterday, he actually, for the first time, was doing drills without a boot on. And again, was not practicing with the team, but like at least doing stuff on court. You know, the thought at the time was probably like mid to late January, but we haven't heard that. That was really just speculation, and it was a combination of speculation and enough, you know, notable national people were throwing that out there that I assume they were getting it from somewhere. So I've always thought like in the next month and a half, he'll be back. But yeah, we haven't really been given an update. I'm hoping the Sixers do that somewhat soon, because, you know, a lot of people were really interested in that. And, you know, as excited as I am for Joel Embiid, I think Ben Simmons is a really great prospect too. So I think when those two are on the floor together, that you're going to start to get a sense of how good the team, good or not good, the team can be in the future.
Right. And looking to that future, I kind of blew by it in that confusing double-parted question. Is there a point where you think, and have the Sixers reached it, where you think that they look at Joel Embiid and say, yes, every decision we make for this coming next many years is based around the fact that he's our guy and we're building everything around him?
You know, it's funny, because when he wasn't playing, like that, the last year especially, when we were talking about, I think when he suffered his second setback, or I guess his first setback, second surgery, so the summer before last, most Sixers fans were like, all right, we just need to assume this guy's never coming back. We can't like make decisions around this. We can't think about how Noel and Okafor fit based on Embiid. You know, I think I had conversations on my podcast about, you know, at what point, this is before he played a game, like at what point do you feel like you can, you know, move ahead and assume he's going to be healthy? Like, what would it take? And we were like, maybe a full season healthy, maybe like going into the season after this season and he's still healthy and playing games and no minutes restriction. It's like, I'm pretty much there right now. It's like hard for me to watch him play and not want the team to make decisions based on Embiid. Like, you know, I know that's foolish, but you know, he's so much better than anything the team's had in so long that I can't not think that way.
Yeah, that makes sense. So thinking towards that, and with all the talk and the chatter around Nerlens Noel not wanting to be in Philadelphia, and with Jahlil Okafor maybe not being a fit alongside Embiid, which one of those guys would you think would get moved first, and which one do you wish it would be if you were making the decision?
I mean, if I were making the decision and both wanted to be here, I would definitely move Okafor. I just think the fit's really bad. I also just think Okafor is a worse player than Noel. His deficiency as a rebounder and as a defender is, you know, something that a lot of people talk about. It's so harmful to a defense to have a center who can't do those two things. And he really hasn't shown that much improvement in his year and a half in the league. Noel has a lot of flaws, like is really not much of a threat on offense. Still, you know, really lacks touch, doesn't have a jump shot at all, is a bad free throw shooter. But I feel like at the center position, if you can block shots, rebound, and defend pick and roll, that's what I care about. Like, if you can be that, like, Biombo-type player, I think that's much more valuable than being, you know, a ball-dominant offensive center off the bench. So, that said, Noel doesn't want to be... It seems like he doesn't want to be here. I think he's good enough that he could start in a number of cities. I just think he doesn't really see a future. If Embiid's going to be here and Embiid's eventually not going to be on a minutes restriction, he's, you know, hopefully eventually going to play back-to-backs and just be a normal NBA player. There's really not that much room for Noel. He'd play 15 minutes off the bench at center. He'd play out of position, I guess, a little bit at power forward, but I think he rightfully so, sees better outcomes for himself if he tries to move on in free agency, and he's restricted coming up. So I think, you know, the contract is the big problem. I think the Sixers are going to look at it and go, all right, we'd rather get something for Noel than get to the summer, have him sign an offer sheet somewhere, and then be forced to either match it or try to reach a sign and trade. So I think they're better off moving him, and I think that's what they will do. Honestly, I think they'll move Noel first. And I think in the future, if Embiid shows he can be healthy, I think they'd probably be better suited just signing a veteran backup center and trading Okafor too, because I just don't think Okafor really gives you what you need at the position.
Are there any possible trades out there that you are eyeing or that you are anticipating or hopeful for?
You know, a lot of people talk about Portland and Boston as two teams that need a defensive center. I've even heard people talk about the Warriors as a destination for Noel, kind of on the cheap. I don't really know what trades are out there. I think Boston probably makes the most sense, and maybe Portland, just because both those teams have guards and the Sixers need that. I don't really know what, you know, say it was Portland, like, you're not getting CJ McCollum. I don't really think the Sixers have any interest in Evan Turner. Maybe Alan Crabb, but I don't know if, like, what he's making, I don't even know if I really want Alan Crabb.
I don't know. That's tough. And you also would assume there'd have to be something else besides just Alan Crabb.
Yeah, like Alan Crabb and a pick. But, you know, and I think Boston makes maybe a little bit more sense. And Noel's from Boston and seems to really like it there. I think he'd happily re-sign there. So I guess that's an option. At the same time, you know, I don't know if, I think Boston has a bit more in the front court than Portland does, in my opinion. At least, they have Amir Johnson, they have Horford. So I don't know if that's even a great situation or how much they'd be willing to give up. I think a lot of teams probably look at it too, like they should. He's going to be a restricted free agent this summer. The Sixers are kind of in a tough spot with the centers on their roster, and maybe they can get him either, you know, in a cheap sign and trade, or pluck him away from the Sixers and they don't match.
Yeah. Would you take Wade Baldwin IV for him?
I haven't watched Wade Baldwin IV at all.
Yeah, that's because he doesn't play. No, I don't think that would be on their radar. What do you think? What do you think the market is for Okafor? Because it does seem like he's in a tough position of being an offensive only center without. You know, that's not a stretch center, which doesn't seem to be the very in vogue these days.
I think Sixers fans have this hope that there is a Byron Scott kind of coach out there, or GM type, who's going to want that from a center. Maybe the Kings, if they moved on from Boogie, would be a destination for him. I think, honestly, I just don't really see it. I think what he does, like you said, he's an offensive center in a league that, you know, really values all the things he can't do. For centers is what the league values right now. I think there are things he could do to raise his value. Like, I think his game he's really talented offensively, and he could be, physically he's pretty talented too. He's, you know, almost 7 feet tall, 7'5" wingspan. He's strong. There's no reason he can't be a better rebounder. I think defense is just something he's never had to really do, and he's just bad at it. My hope was that it would improve this summer. He was hurt pretty much the whole summer, recovering from a knee injury, so he didn't really get much practice time. You know, there's still, I guess, a world in which he makes some improvements in those two areas and becomes like more of an Enes Kanter kind of. People see him as that kind of big off the bench. But right now, you know, he doesn't do the thing Enes Kanter does best, which is rebound. And while he has the potential to do some of those things, he just hasn't shown any of that. I think his offensive game is pretty efficient when he doesn't go iso ball. He can finish around the rim. He's decent when he wants to be as a pick and roll guy, although he's lazy with the screens he sets. It's just, you know, a lot of talent, and he hasn't really put much of it together. So I just don't see much value there. I think the Sixers, because he has this year and then two more years after this, would be best served just keeping him around and seeing if he develops, and then maybe moving him at a higher point. I think right now his value is pretty low.
Yeah. Wrapping up, a couple more questions. as someone who has fully experienced the depths of tanking, is there a lottery reform or some kind of reform for, you know, the picks that you would be in favor of?
You know, honestly, I think this is going to sound like I'm just saying this because I'm a Sixers fan. I think the lottery itself creates more of a problem than it solves. I think if you allowed teams to bottom, like the Sixers to bottom out, have control over their draft spot, get the guys they need, and then from there move on, I think you're better served doing that than what we have now, which is like the Sixers, you know, the first 2 years of their tank ended up with a third pick both years, and it wasn't good enough, and they just needed to tank again, basically. Mm-hmm. I don't really know if the lottery really accomplishes what it's supposed to, because as long as the odds are as great as they are, you know, or as beneficial for the teams at the top as they are, it doesn't keep teams from tanking, certainly, as we've seen. I think all it does is teams try to tank, it doesn't work, and then they're still in a bad spot and want to tank again. So, and I think while there's, you know, there's something attractive about like, okay, the bottom six teams will all have a 10% chance, and then we'll, from there, it'll rank, you know, ramp down or whatever. I think it misses the point that there's a reason the draft works like it does. It's so teams like the Sixers, like the Timberwolves, like the Bucks a few years ago can like get talent and get better. Because without that, I think, you know, there's already such an advantage that large market teams have in the NBA. And Philadelphia is not a small market team by any means. But, you know, I think it's counterintuitive to create a system where like no longer can teams, really bad teams, get high picks, because then you're just in a situation. And like, certainly the wheel is like the absolute, I remember when that was a big point of conversation like 2 years ago, where like every team over a 30 year span gets the same number of picks at each spot. Like, I just think it kind of defeats the purpose. Like, you miss on one of those picks, and then, you know, you get a top five pick every 5 years, you miss on one of them, you draft Hashim Thabeet, and now you're waiting 6 years to get another top pick. So it's just, as a fan, I think this maximizes, like, either your team is good, or it's rebuilding and you have some hope about who you're going to get in the draft, or you're in that middle ground. The middle ground kind of sucks, but at least there's that false hope we talked about earlier where, right, like, you think something might break for your team.
And the hope sells tickets, which is important for the NBA. Like, if you were down on the wheel, and then, you know, it's hard to sell the season ticket packages if your team's struggling. I haven't come up with a complete idea like that I think is perfect, but in my mind, I would like there to be some kind of, yeah, you know, you can tank, but if you don't win 20 games, you're just out of luck. Like, I feel like teams should be incentivized to win basketball games, period. And it's like, if you're really bad, I understand, like, all right, we're going to be bad, but I would like to see some cutoff of, like, you have to actually convince us you're trying to win some basketball. And I don't know if it would be like a team, we need to win at least 18 games or 22 games or something. Otherwise, like, your odds go way down or something. Because I would like to see more where teams are trying to win every night, even though it does lead for some fun, you know, Mark Madsen shooting 10 threes in a late, you know, March, April game type things.
Yeah. I think no matter where you, cause I've heard a lot of that, or like, you know, the bottom two teams get like the fifth and sixth pick, and then the 3, 4, 5 teams get the 1, 2, you know, that kind of thing. And it's like, now you're kind of just moving the mark of where teams are going to tank. Like, now, right, teams are going to be just good enough to get to 18, and then like nothing better, and then tank from there. I guess it does solve the problem of like season long tanking. What would you think about? I lost it. I had this idea in my head while you were talking, and now I totally lost it.
You probably just solved lottery reform.
I solved it, and I'll never get it back. What would you think about a system where a team that picks first overall, or, you know, let's say whatever team, like the Sixers, since they picked first overall last year, can't pick first overall for the next like 2 years after that or something. Or if they pick second, they can't pick, you know, whatever, you know.
Oh, like you could only have
basically make it so you can't, you like, if the Sixers came up first in this lottery, their balls would be put back in and they do it again until the Sixers fall below where they picked last year.
I think that's fine. I mean, I don't know if that would solve, I don't have as big an issue over a team picking, like, with the Cavs got 3 first round picks in 5 or 6 years or something. Like, for me, it's just, I want the teams to be rewarded for I feel like if you fight and scrap your way to 28 wins and your team is terrible, I feel like there should be a reward for that, as opposed to a team that's like, hey, we're bad, let's lose our last 15 games, and now we get a pick ahead of this other team that was, you know, fighting for the playoffs for a while. But yeah, I don't,
yeah,
who knows what that solution is.
It's such a, yeah, it's like, as someone who watched a tanking team, I totally understand it. And like, frankly, I, you know, as much fun as I had, like, weird fun watching, like, you know, Furkan Aldemir and Jakar Sampson play minutes, and like,
oh yeah,
you know, it was like a weird experience, and you know, people who were on board with it like had fun with it on Twitter, and I think it was interesting and different in that way. I wish there were a way to rebuild in the NBA that weren't that, but I don't know if getting rid of tanking, I think it creates all these other problems like we talked about, where teams are just perpetually bad. Like the Brooklyn Nets right now are the saddest. I can't, you know, in terms of sports, like, they're just the saddest situation. And I feel like any kind of lottery reform that takes away a team's ability to be bad and get high picks, whether that's like flattening the odds for every non-playoff team, which then creates tanking around, you know, the last playoff spot. But like, anything you do like that, or just flattening the odds in general to the point where like the worst team in the league can still pick 10th. I think you put yourself in a situation where there are fan bases that are put in that Nets situation where you're terrible, but there's like not an easy way out of it.
Yeah. Maybe we just need relegation. Get a English soccer style. Start sending teams down. All right. Last question. Since reading the Hinkie letter, how have you, Max, optimized your life?
You know, I'm not really following any of Hinkie's, you know, I haven't set my watch to go off every hour. I do think he had some interesting, in his letter, he had some interesting author suggestions. I did look at some of those. I thought, and some of them I'd already read some books from or read some stuff from. But, you know, I don't think that I'm really I think what gets lost sometimes in the process, you know, fandom thing is, you know, and I'm someone who certainly has done a lot of like standing up for Sam Hinkie online. I think it's less so me standing up for Sam Hinkie and more so me standing up that like, hey, with the way the rules are right now, this was the way to do it. And Sam Hinkie was right about that. Now, he may have been wrong about drafting, or certainly was wrong about drafting Jahlil Okafor over Porzingis. You know, you can argue whether like he should have been able to foresee Giannis, you know, at that 11 spot, picking MCW there. I call myself more of a process stan than like a Sam Hinkie stan. You know, I don't think everything Sam Hinkie did was right necessarily. I don't think he handled it. Certainly didn't, you know, maximize the process, especially with hindsight. But like, I think for me, the lesson I learned wasn't all his like life hacks that he talked about. It was more just like looking at your situation, figuring out what the best, you know, in terms of just raw data, what you know, what the best course from here is, and sticking to that even when it's difficult. That's maybe what I've learned from the process, even more than Sam Hinkie.
That was a very thoughtful and sincere answer. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Hey, Max, tell people where they can buy your t-shirts and hear your voice on your podcast and things.
Sure. So if you go to Twitter, my handle is Max Rappaport, MaxRappaport. In my bio, I have all this information, but the podcast is the Step Over podcast, like Allen Iverson's Step Over. The t-shirts are, this is like always difficult to say on a podcast or tell people, it's Optionalities, spelled like the thing Sam Hinkie said, optionality. But so it's Option Ala, like Alites, like t-shirts. But you can find that on my Twitter account in the bio.
Yeah. So you guys go buy a awesome Nerlens Noel tee before he gets traded. All right. Hey, thanks Max for your time, and good luck to you and the Sixers.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
All right, that was great stuff from Max Rappaport. You guys go check him out on Twitter and support him. Thanks you all for listening. Check out our Patreon, patreon.com/fastbreakbreakfast, for ways you can support our podcast. We really appreciate those intrepid souls who have done just that. Follow us on Twitter at @fastbreakbreak. Like us on Facebook. You guys are the best. Thanks for listening. And remember, breakfast is the most important thing.